This podcast is designed for the purpose of entertainment and information and is not meant to be considered medical advice.
What? It's not?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, our lawyer said we can't do that anymore.
Aww.
Where do some of these names come from?
Histrionic personality disorder comes from the uterus, Jonathan, because that's the seat of emotion.
not just any uterus, a wandering uterus.
That's so true, yes, yes.
Show about medicine.
Prescriptions sold separately.
The guy you just heard is Dr. Christopher Labos.
And the other guy is Jonathan Jarry. I'm a doctor, but he's not.
Sorry that I did biomedical research instead. Jeez.
And we're gonna look at the evidence behind medical topics, and the show is
called... Wait. No, I wanna say it.
I wanna say it.
I came up with it. It's the body
the
of...
The body of evidence.
It's the body of evidence.
You totally stole that from Madonna.
We are joined by Professor Carla Sharp, the director of both the Developmental Psychopathology Lab and the Adolescent Diagnosis Assessment Prevention and Treatment Center at the University of Houston. She holds a doctorate in developmental psychopathology from the University of Cambridge. She specializes in borderline personality disorder and came to our attention because she wrote a review article for the New England Journal of Medicine on personality disorders. And it's a topic that we had been wanting to cover for a while. Yeah. So thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And by the end of the episode, you'll find out what mental pathologies Jonathan actually has.
Hey, it's very difficult to find a good mental health professional in Quebec, given the state of our healthcare system. So this is the best thing that I can do.
That is very true. Very true.
So we will be talking about conditions like schizoid personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and of course, borderline personality disorder. And there is a long history of Hollywood exploiting these conditions and also exploiting more serious mental illness and often linking them to crime. And it's not just Hollywood. The entire Batman canon seems to equate mental disorders with criminality. So before we dig into what personality disorders and psychopathology broadly actually are, how do you feel about their representation in scripted media?
Oh, I think it's unfortunate in some ways that I think there are multiple ways in which psychopathology and personality disorders, in particular, are represented in the media. It can go either way, really. Sometimes I think it's glamorized. For instance, in the case of a very clever psychopath, there's multiple TV programs of clever psychopaths that that one, begins to love after a while, even though they've, killed 22 people. And then sometimes it goes the other way, with a sort of a deviant representation, and it gets stigmatized. So, I don't blame Hollywood in a way for this, because that's their bread and butter and they need to make shows and movies that sell. And so I do understand that. But I do think we do have a responsibility as society to understand mental health for what it is, and to appreciate the immense suffering and distress that are associated with mental health problems, including personality disorder.
It's funny because even a good movie like Beautiful Mind, which attempted to portray, the impact that mental health has on, a patient and his family, they take a lot of liberties, because in A Beautiful Mind, I forget the main character's name, he has schizophrenia. They present all his hallucinations as visual hallucinations, even though in schizophrenia it's often auditory hallucinations. And I mean, I understand why they do that, but it seems to rarely be done well in Hollywood that they portray mental illness accurately, because I understand things have to, be in service of a story, but it seems like they do it more so with mental illness than they do with other things.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. You know, thinking about personality disorder, one of the sort of famous portrayals of borderline personality disorder is Glenn Close's character in Fatal Attraction.
Yeah.
If I don't know how old the two of you are, but
They would actually teach us that when I was in medical school. They brought that up as an example to explain the condition to us.
Oh, so let me start by saying, you know, this is a disorder. Borderline personality disorder is a disorder in flux in terms of its definition. We currently have two diagnostic approaches to diagnosing personality disorder. And I should just for your listeners also clarify that what we use to diagnose personality disorder and all mental health disorders in the United States and North America is called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. And we're currently in the fifth edition of the DSM. The first one came out in the 1950s. In Europe and the rest of the world, folks use the ICD-11, the International Classification System for Disorders in General, medical disorders, and mental disorders just forms one category of that. But in the DSM, you have two sections and two approaches to diagnosing personality disorder and borderline personality disorder in particular. In section two of the DSM, you have 9 criteria for BPD. This includes affective instability, so emotional instability, anger problems, feelings of emptiness, self-harm and suicidality, relationship problems, identity problems, impulsivity, and abandonment fears. So when you have more than 5 of those criteria, a clinical psychologist or a psychiatrist may diagnose you as having borderline personality disorder or BPD. There's been lots of problems with that, and I can go into more detail about those problems. But as a result of these issues in validity and reliability for BPD, the DSM-5 work group up to 2013 worked on a new diagnostic system for personality disorder. And now we can find that diagnostic approach in section 3 of the DSM. And so this is a very different approach to evaluating personality disorder. And you referenced the paper that I wrote. And I tried my best in that paper to represent both approaches. Unfortunately, the section 2 approach is the one that is the mainstream approach to diagnosing personality disorder, while the section 3 approach is actually empirically stronger, but is not legitimized in the main body of the DSM, the section 2. And so clinicians rarely use a section 3 personality disorder diagnosis and continue to rely on a somewhat faulty approach to personality disorder as it is described in section 2.
When I was in training, I was taught on axis 1, axis 2. Is that no longer the framework for diagnosing mental illness now? Has it evolved with the new DSM?
It has evolved. So with DSM-5, they actually let go of the 5-axis system. And, you know, the interesting thing about the 5-axis system was originally clinicians and researchers who were in the personality disorder field were excited about the 5-axis system because what it did was it differentiated between clinical syndromes on axis 1 and conditions that are more persistent and pervasive, and also developmental on axis 2. So you would find autism spectrum disorders on axis 2. You would find disabilities, cognitive disabilities on axis 2, and you would find the personality disorders on axis 2. The problem was that that also didn't actually represent the data very well, because it turns out in the case of personality disorder that it is not as stable and persistent as people thought. You know, probably because of the word personality, and we tend to think that personality is stable, there was an assumption that personality disorder describes who a person is and that that could become disordered, and that that's just now how you are for life. And actually, the data says or paints a different picture. We now know that personality disorder is not that stable. It is actually functions in the same way, exactly like depression, anxiety, and some of those other syndromes that used to be on Axis One. It comes and goes. You have bad personality disorder days and good personality disorder days. And it isn't as pervasive as people thought either. And so, you know, for this and many other reasons, the five-axis system was moved away from, and everything is now just simply diagnosed on one axis, if you will. And that's probably more appropriate. The problem with that is that there are now movements to really let go of the personality disorder construct altogether. And in some ways, the Axis II protected personality disorder diagnosis from being completely relegated. So that's a new problem that we have with the fact that we let go of the five-axis system.
You mentioned psychopathy earlier. I want to come back to that because, you know, of course, the quote-unquote psychopaths are often portrayed in popular culture as lacking feelings, as being ruthless, as being manipulative. We also hear that a large proportion of CEOs in real life are psychopaths. Surgeons as well are drawn, you know, psychopaths are drawn to surgery. Is psychopathy the same as sociopathy? And are those even clinical diagnoses?
You know, that's such a good observation. Sociopathy was a term used few decades ago to describe the psychopath. The field moved away from that idea towards the psychopathy construct because the sociopath construct suggested was stigmatized more. And so people moved towards the psychopathy construct. You're right that it isn't a formal diagnosis in the sense of the other personality disorders. Where psychopathy lives in the DSM is mostly under the umbrella of antisocial personality disorders. So in section two that I referenced earlier, there are 10 personality disorders. Three of them are in what we used to call cluster A. They're the eccentric group. It's paranoid personality disorder, schizoid, and schizotypical personality disorder. These are folks who are not very social. They keep to themselves, and they are viewed by others as quite eccentric. And then you've got cluster B personality disorder. And again, we don't use the clusters anymore, but it is a sort of useful way to think about the 10 categories if you want to still use those 10 categories. But the cluster B personality disorders is borderline personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, and histrionic personality disorder. And what they share are dramatic, erratic features. So it's in that cluster that psychopathy lives. The third cluster are people that are also kind of loners, but they are not, they're loners not because they're eccentric and avoid people like cluster A. They are loners because they're very, very anxious around people. So that would be obsessive compulsive personality disorder, avoidant personality disorder, and dependent personality disorder. As I said before, there is actually very little evidence that these 10 personality disorders exist like that in nature. And I'm happy to expand on why that is. Coming back to psychopathy you would most often then find in individuals who get diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. But in recent years, we rather view psychopathy as a cluster of traits that you can find in other personality disorders as well, or even in people that don't have personality disorder but have these callous and emotional traits that make it easy for them to exploit others and, you know, to hurt others without feeling bad about it.
We haven't even really defined this, but given all of this, how much flux there is, what even is a personality disorder? How is it defined, and how does it differ from just quote-unquote normal variations in personality types?
Its formal definition is as a plot device if you're writing a manuscript.
Well, You know, that's such a good question. And that is the horny question, really. You know, what is personality disorder really? And, you know, the current view and the one that I would say is best supported by empirical research is the idea that the core feature of a personality disorder, regardless of the way it manifests, is maladaptive self and interpersonal functioning. So if you know something about psychopathology generally, all psychopathology is associated with some problems in self-functioning and interpersonal functioning. However, in disorders like depression and anxiety, substance use, you know, ADHD, the social problems, the problems you have in relationships and the problems you have in self-functioning is really a consequence of the other disorders. So for instance, in depression, you have really a problem in the mood system. And because you become depressed, you then start to withdraw from others and you begin to feel bad about yourself. In personality disorder, it's flipped. The maladaptive self and interpersonal functioning is the primary source, the primary cause of the psychopathology. And so, you know, that is the difference between the two. So across all personality disorder, whether it's a sort of antisocial manifestation, whether it's a narcissistic manifestation, whether it's an obsessive compulsive manifestation or a borderline manifestation, what all of these flavors of personality disorder share is really the fact that you can't get on with people, lots of relationship problems, and that you can't manage yourself. So you have problems in self-directedness, can't reach your personal goals, and you have problems in identity. Your identity is in flux. You can't really hang on to yourself, especially in the context of interpersonal situations that are emotionally charged. And these are often attachment relationships, so our relationships with the people that we really need for our support and sanity. So that's the core of personality disorder. And that, in fact, is how we now define it in Section 3 of the DSM. This approach to personality disorder diagnosis is called the alternative model for personality disorder. And the one that I think will be the approach that we have going forward, this is also the approach that the ICD-11 has now adopted.
How common are personality disorders? What I remember reading about them is about 10% of the population has one, and that each disorder has affects about 1% of the population. Is that correct?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. If we look at the data for any personality disorder, it can be up to 10%. If we delve into each of the 10 categories, they vary a little bit. Borderline personality disorder is a little bit more common. Avoidant personality disorder is a little bit more common, at about 3%. Some epidemiological studies will go a little bit higher. It really depends on the study, the methods. But then some are quite, you know, low in prevalence. So, you know, this schizotypical disorder or schizoid, are lower in prevalence. It's hard though to know whether those low prevalence rates is really got to do something with a poor assessment of these personality disorders, or whether it's, you know, in other words, do they really exist? So for instance, histrionic personality disorder, we're pretty sure that it doesn't exist. And so if it has lower prevalence rates, it's probably because it's not a valid disorder, rather than the fact that it truly has a low prevalence rate. I do think disorders like borderline personality disorder exist, perhaps not in the categorical way that Section 2 describes it, but that there are people who have those kind of problems is the case, because we see that in clinical practice, and these are individuals who don't really fit any other category in the mood disorders or substance disorders and so forth.
You mentioned that histrionic personality disorder might not exist. I mean, just given the name, it brings to my mind some very antiquated misogynistic notions of how women should behave according to men. Is that how it came about? Is that why it may not be real?
Because it's not the Victorian era anymore.
I'm so glad you raised that. Yeah, I think, you know, there were all kinds of ways of depicting women. And, you know, poor Freud, I think, was blamed first for that. That women are hysteric and that the histrionic personality disorder construct is really developed out of that tradition. And it is a sort of frivolous, superficial person who has no depth. And, you know, also suffers from some of the problems that people with BPD suffers from, feelings of emptiness and aloneness and abandonment fears. But it has this sort of frivolous, superficial presentation. But yeah, these are one of these. So when DSM-5 moved or started incorporating Section 3, the alternative model, histrionic personality disorders were one of the ones that was dropped. And so dependent personality disorder was dropped as well. Schizoid personality disorder was dropped because it really belongs to the schizophrenic spectrum disorders. Similarly, paranoid personality disorder was dropped because it really does belong better on the schizophrenic spectrum of disorders rather than in the personality disorders.
So that's an interesting thing that you point out. So there's a thing called schizoid personality disorder, schizotypal personality disorder, and then there's schizophrenia. What is the difference between a personality disorder and something that sounds like it, but that is something like a full-fledged schizophrenia, for example?
So, you know, I think we're scratching the surface of understanding this. And, you know, I can recommend folks who are better talking about that spectrum than me. But, you know, typically we have seen a person with schizophrenia proper as someone with hallucinations and delusions. And that would be those positive symptoms of schizophrenia would be the way we diagnose them. And, you know, in combination with some of the negative symptoms, which is really being asocial, not wanting to be social. Schizoid and schizotypical disorder overlap with schizophrenic disorders because we also see that almost those negative symptoms of not wanting to, you know, socialize with people, really being loners. And then they have these, what we used to call pseudo-psychotic experiences. So, you know, people with schizotypal personality disorder in the old system would have, you know, weird ideas about things. You know, they would believe things. They're not delusional and they're perfectly in touch with reality, but they have odd ways of seeing the world. You know, they would, I remember when I was, you know, studying, you know, they would be, this was in the 90s, there would be young people on campus, you know, walking barefoot and flowers in their hair. And, you know, and they, they think, you know, differently about life. Those are people that have high schizotypical traits. Schizoid people are just people that are really, really not wanting to mix with others and also have these sort of pseudo-psychotic symptoms, even though they remain in touch with reality. So that was always the differentiating factor, whether a person remains in touch with reality. Now we see this because we've placed schizophrenia on a spectrum, on a dimension, we are now able to also place individuals who are still in touch with reality but have these odd experiences with reality also on the same spectrum. And that's where schizoid and schizotypal now find themselves.
When do these disorders, generally speaking, when do they typically arise over the course of a lifetime? And do some of them affect more men than women and vice versa?
You know, this is another huge advance that we made, I would say, in the last 10 to 20 years, really acknowledging that the personality disorders emerge in adolescence. Because we had these wrong ideas about personality functioning, we thought that, you know, you wake up on your 19th birthday and you suddenly have a personality. And when you are 14, you don't have a personality. We now know that that's not the case. And that when we shifted our lens to understand that personality is actually equally stable in childhood, adolescence, and adulthood, we were able to say, okay, when does personality disorder really show for the first time? And most clinicians, researchers agree that the onset period is in adolescence. You can find children, pre-adolescent, who are high in some of these maladaptive traits. So an impulsive young person, an emotional young person, that doesn't mean that they have personality disorder. We have to wait until adolescence when we can see how this person is managing their traits, how are they managing themselves in the context of intimate relationships. And if they are doing that well, despite the fact that they're impulsive or emotional, they don't have a personality disorder. But if those traits are making it hard for them to get on with people and to manage themselves, then we are considering personality disorder. So that's one of the big advances, is to actually assess personality disorder in adolescence and then begin to treat it, because there's a lot of protective factors in adolescence that begin to disappear as young people age into adulthood.
And Jonathan, specifically to your question about the gender, you know, between men and women personality disorders, histrionic personality disorder, almost exclusively in women. Almost conspicuously
shocking.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't really answer your question about gender expressions. This is sort of an interesting question. And I think where we stand right now, I'm not a proponent of categorical diagnosis. So I don't think they are helpful for us to understand or treat personality disorder or any mental health disorder for that matter. What is helpful, though, is thinking about dimensions. And there are two dimensions that I think are to some extent, or the data shows that they are to some extent gendered. And this is internalizing psychopathology and externalizing psychopathology. And these are very broad dimensions that explain covariation in symptoms across traditional categorical disorders. And what we mean with externalizing dimension is externalizing your distress. So that would mean, being angry or being more behavioral in expression of your distress. Internalizing disorders are ones in which you really turn your distress inward and you don't really express it outward so clearly. And there does seem to be some patterns for men to be on the externalizing side and for women to be on the internalizing side, although I think it would be a mistake to dichotomize it in that way. There are, I think it is dimensional, which means that men and women will have features of both. Women may just have more features of internalizing manifestations, while men may have more features of externalizing manifestation.
Do we know what causes personality disorders? I'm guessing there's not like one mutation in one gene. Is it a polygenic trait? So there are different genetic risk factors that kind of, all increase your risk of having one of these disorders. Is it environmental? Is it a combination of the two? What do we know so far?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's like all mental disorders, it's polygenetic, and it is also a confluence between environment and biological factors. So, we do know that personality disorder to some extent run in families. Twin studies show that to us, that, you have a higher chance of being of having a personality disorder if someone in your family has a family, and twin studies show that what gets passed on is your temperamental characteristics. So things like what I mentioned before, level of emotionality, level of reactivity, impulsivity, those are the things that get passed on. Whether they then turn into a personality disorder or not is going to depend on the environment. So you can imagine a highly emotional, reactive child who's impulsive, and a caregiver who is able to patiently regulate this child over time. I always think about the work that parents do. You may remember in Karate Kid, when he wants to learn to fight, his teacher teaches him to wax on and wax off and wax on and wax off before he actually gets to fight. And that is really for those muscle memory to build. Parents fulfill the same function. There's a serve and a return, a serve and a return, a serve and a return between a caregiver and a child. And what that builds over time is a sense of self and a sense that you can manage interpersonal relationships. But it takes a very, very patient caregiver if a child is very reactive and emotional. And sometimes caregivers cannot match the intensity of a child for lots of different reasons. And in that case, what may happen then in the serve and return is a model of self or a sense of self that is essentially defective or bad, and an inability to regulate the self in the context of interpersonal relationships. And then that is when we start seeing a personality disorder emerge. So in that sense, it is this interaction between biological temperamental factors and the environment. Not to say that parents is the only environment that counts. You know, I think school matters. We now know there's data on the fact that young people with personality disorder do have a history of being bullied. Again, it would be complex interactions between temperamental factors and how the environment responds to that.
Are you arguing that Dr. Spock's book on child rearing should be replaced by a book written by Mr. Miyagi?
It totally should.
I like that.
Wax on, right hand. Wax off, left hand. Wax on, wax off. Breathe in through nose, out the mouth.
I'm curious about something because I was taught in school when I was doing my training that a household that had a high emotionality index, so like a household where everybody yelled, where things were a little bit chaotic, that could induce to an extent mental illness in somebody who had a predisposition. Are you saying that sort of the converse of that is true? Is that a household that is very calm and supportive and very responsive to a child's needs can sort of suppress a tendency towards a mental illness or a personality disorder?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am a strong believer in the power of caregiving. And, you know, I'm a parent of a 14-year-old and an 8-year-old, and it's been a humbling experience for me because it is not an easy job. And I think I take my hat off for each parent who can stay calm and stay with their child. And that is the job of the parent in the end, is to build those resilience factors. There are going to be lots of things that's going to interfere with that. At no fault of the parent, there's going to be sociopolitical things, there's going to be trauma, there is going to be all kinds of migration is going to interfere with it, all kinds of things that interfere with the parent's capacity to provide those resilient factors and protect against mental health. But I think parents play a huge part in building that kind of resilience against the onset of mental health problems.
But at least now you have two people who can wax your car, so that's good.
That helps. I want to follow up on something that Jonathan asked. He was talking about sort of, you know, the biological causes of this. For things like schizophrenia and depression, we can point to, you know, obviously it's more complex, but for schizophrenia, you can say it's too much dopamine. When it comes to depression, you can say it's too little serotonin in the brain. It's obviously a lot more complex than that, but you can point to these obvious organic causes. Mm. Do we have anything similar in personality disorders or not really?
Oh, I think it's like a holy grail at the moment. You know, I don't know how familiar you are with the research domain criteria that the NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, formulated about almost 10 years ago now. Because of dissatisfaction with a categorical approach to diagnosing mental disorders, the NIMH was pushing a dimensional approach to mental illness that has really a foundation in the brain. And so, for instance, you mentioned depression and serotonin or, you know, substance use and dopamine. And you can go find those correlates very clearly in the RDoC system for these traditional syndromes. Personality disorder lives, however, in the RDoC system that we call systems for social processes. And there really is, at this point in time, no clear neurobiological correlates for it. People have been looking in places like oxytocin, to find, you know, a relationship, biological correlate. But at the moment, we really don't have anything in the brain that we can pinpoint that says this is the correlate of self-function or this is the correlate of interpersonal function. And here is a medication that can regulate that. So I think at the moment, there is no FDA-approved medication for personality disorder. What we treat as psychiatrists for personality disorder is really the comorbid disorder. So, and because this is absolutely the case, if you do have a personality disorder, you likely also have depression and anxiety. I think the comorbidity rate is about 60 to 70%. And what the medication ends up treating is the anxiety and the depression. But the core of the disorder, the maladaptive self and interpersonal functioning, you can only address with psychotherapy. And so what ends up happening is people get, you know, a lot of drugs, doesn't actually move the needle on the core pathology, and the suffering continues until a person gets to a relationally based psychotherapy that actually addresses the core of the disorder. People don't really get better.
One of our listeners wanted to know if autism was frequently associated with one or some of these personality disorders. So if you have autism, are you more likely or less likely to have a personality disorder in general or to have one specifically?
I would not say there is enough data to say that these co-occur. So the answer is no. If you have autism, autism spectrum disorder, you are not more likely to have a personality disorder. What I do think happen is misdiagnosis. So I do think that sometimes people who have could be a manifestation of avoidance, what we used to call in section two, avoidant personality disorder, or anxious in social situations, all of those cluster C or cluster A manifestations of personality disorder, they may get diagnosed as autism spectrum disorders because autism is less stigmatized than personality disorder. And we think that, you know, there is more resources available for autism, including, you know, insurance coverage. Often I think a misdiagnosis takes place, and people who really should be getting a personality disorder diagnosis ends up getting an autistic spectrum diagnosis. But I don't think there's a lot of evidence suggesting that those two disorders co-occur in the same way that depression, anxiety, and personality and substance use co-occur.
I was curious to know if, and I hinted at this at the beginning when I was talking about psychopathy, but if people with certain personality disorders, if they gravitate towards certain jobs, for example. So if somebody has an antisocial PD, are they more drawn to fields like surgery, for example, or is that just really a myth?
I have some thoughts on the issue, but I'll let you answer.
You know, I think there are some studies. There's not a lot, you know. So, I mean, you know, we always say if you can do a meta-analysis on data, then you know it. You know, we're approximating some kind of truth. You know, so I don't think we're there yet in terms of really knowing whether there are certain professions that are associated with personality disorder. I do think there are studies, but again, not at the meta-analytic level, but there are studies that have shown higher levels of, for instance, narcissistic traits in certain professions, and also some of these more psychopathic traits, you know, just being able to stay calm and not being affected so much. But whether that's really considered pathological, I wouldn't go as far as to say that surgeons would be pathological, or that, you know, guys that play the stock market are, you know, psychopaths, or, you know, that movie stars are narcissistic by, you know, politicians, you know, but I think if we think dimensionally about personality, those professions may be associated with higher trait levels. It may or may not be psychopathic. I won't get into details, but I think there are some politicians in the recent history of the United States that perhaps cross over into pathological behavior in these traits. But by and large, I would say these are just folks that have high levels of traits and actually manage to have a functional life, we always come back in personality disorder to ask, are you able to have love and work? It's actually two concepts that Freud talked about, love and work. And if you can have love and work, even if you, you know, play the stock market or a race car driver or a surgeon, you know, good for you. You have found a way of channeling some of those high level traits into something adaptive.
I mean, we often joke about how, you know, everybody in medicine is a type A personality, but the reality is, you know, it's a job. It requires a certain skill set. It's not surprising that the people in it would have a certain skill set. You know, you tend not to get into medicine if you're disorganized and kind of lazy. So, you know, it's not surprising to me that certain personality traits would congregate together in certain professions, because there's a reason why we have the expression birds of a feather flock together.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that, you know, and you do want, you know, certain traits to be, you know, if I think about psychologists, they are often people who are sensitive, who are, who are the kind of people that can do psychotherapy, and that's how it should be. You know, now that same sensitivity could be, you know, a borderline presentation if it wasn't managed well. So, you know, again, a trait per se, or high levels of a trait per se, or low levels of a trait per se, is not dysfunctional. It is really what we do with it, how we manage it. And that's why the core function of personality is really that self-management, that self-regulation piece, rather than the traits themselves.
Borderline personality disorder sounds like somebody just barely has a personality. It's a very weird, antiquated, counterintuitive name, and there are others like that in those PDs. Where do some of these names come from, and has there been a push to revamp them? I know that, you know, I did my master's on a form of muscular dystrophy, and it's very interesting there how the names for limb girdle muscular dystrophies have evolved over time. They started being these very kind of imprecise, very long names based on clinical manifestation, and then they became these letter and number systems based on their genetics. Where do some of these names come from?
Histrionic personality disorder comes from the uterus, Jonathan, because that's the seat of emotion.
Yeah, not just any uterus, a wandering uterus.
That's so true, yes.
So no, a borderline in particular is interesting. It was originally used to describe the border between psychosis and neurosis, and it's sort of the mid-1900s, folks were thinking about mental health problems as either neurotic, so that would in today's language be depression and anxiety, or psychotic, which in today's language would be schizophrenia. But there was this group of people who presented more severe than neurotic disorders, than anxiety and depression, but not quite as severe as the psychotic individuals. And so this term was identified as borderline, somewhere between the border between neurotic and psychotic, and that then became borderline personality disorder. I do think it's a very stigmatized disorder. It really doesn't deserve to be stigmatized, because all it means is that a person is struggling to hold onto themselves in the serve and return with other people. And that's something that we can work on in psychotherapy. You know, it doesn't mean you're wrong as a person. So it is an unfortunate, you know, both borderline is unfortunate and personality is unfortunate, because we misunderstand what we mean with personality. And so it has become quite stigmatized. There are movements to change the name. People talk about emotion dysregulation disorder or emotional intensity disorder. I don't think changing the name is going to destigmatize it. What will destigmatize it is if, you know, both clinicians and the general public understand it for what it is. And, you know, I just congratulate you guys for doing this kind of podcast, because then we can begin to demystify what it really means. And then it doesn't really matter what we call it. The question is, is it something that we can treat? Yes. Is it something that gets better? Yes. Is it something that doesn't mean you're a bad person? Yes. You know, so I think once we begin to understand what it really means, it really doesn't matter what we call it. So for me personally, I think we can move away from borderline personality disorder. We can just talk about personality difficulties, personality challenges, personality functioning, rather than, you know, borderline or personality disorder.
Speaking of controversies and stigma, I've read a little about the controversy over dissociative identity disorder, formerly known as multiple personality disorder.
Yeah.
Is it considered a personality disorder? And what are your thoughts on whether or not it exists as a distinct clinical entity?
Yeah, that is a big controversy. And, you know, it is sort of a North American invention, multiple personality disorder. It's never lived in the personality disorder chapter of the DSM. It's always lived in the dissociative disorders chapter, because there, you know, if you think what personality disorder is, it really stays in touch with reality, while the dissociative disorders are seen to sort of, you know, have a complete break with reality, in that you can think that you are another person and you believe it. I personally don't believe in DID or multiple personality disorder. I think it is a state that a person can go into for multiple reasons. It may be an unconscious dissociative state in which a person protecting themselves against a very intense negative emotion. But I don't think it's a different personality that really exists. It's been very interesting for us to see in our adolescent clinic. I don't know if you are familiar with Discord, but this is a site that many young people visit, and they try on some of these disorders, like dissociative identity disorder, and, come to the clinic and then want to be diagnosed with it as some kind of validation of their distress. And I mean, the work that needs to be done in that case is really helping a young person get in touch with their distress in a way that doesn't need trying on a different personality. But yeah, so that's my position on it. There are some clinicians out there that believe it exists, but we don't see it in other cultures, not even in other Western cultures so much as we see it in North America.
You mentioned psychotherapy before. As we wrap up, I think some people may think that anyone who's diagnosed with a personality disorder gets shipped off to Arkham Asylum. But what are some of the treatment options for these disorders in general? And can they improve over time, either with treatment or without treatment?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because there's been this therapeutic nihilism about personality disorders. People absolutely get better. It is a very treatable disorder. It's actually as treatable as depression and anxiety. So that sort of therapeutic nihilism is really unwarranted. Best approach to treatment of personality disorder is through psychotherapy. There are two main evidence-based ones, dialectical behavior therapy and mentalization-based therapy. There are other really good therapies as well that have an emerging evidence base, which is called transference-focused therapy, schema therapy, cognitive analytic therapy. So I think all of these therapeutic approaches can absolutely turn it around for people. And the other interesting thing is, personality disorders seem to get better to some extent by itself as well. And so we do see a sort of reduction in personality disorder symptoms. There is still functional impairment and still a lot of distress, but people do seem to also get better by themselves. So yeah, I'm glad that you asked that question, and that folks don't feel that they have to suffer in silence. The important thing is to name it, to get it diagnosed, and not to stigmatize it, so that the correct treatment can be given to a person.
If people want to find you and your work online, where would they go? Are you on Discord? Are you on Twitter? where would they go to find you?
You know, I'm very old school. Google my name and, you know, you'll find me at the University of Houston. And people are so welcome to contact me. You know, I'm always very eager to help people, especially if they have young people that they are worried about, adolescents and young adults. That's really my bread and butter. I would also encourage people to visit websites like the NEABPD, the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder, NEABPD. It's a wonderful resource for BPD. There are other wonderful groups as well, like the SASHBEAR Foundation in Canada, Emotions Matter, which is sort of functioning out of New York City. There are variants of this in the UK and Australia. So just, you know, these are wonderful resources that can be accessed as well. But I'm very happy for folks to contact me personally and help them navigate all this.
Well, Professor Carla Sharp, thank you very much for your time and for your expertise.
Thank you. And thanks for addressing this topic.
And that's the end of our show this month. Our theme music is Fall of the Ocean Queen by Joseph Hackel. Our illustrator is Luke Ouellette. If you want to support the show, find us on Patreon. All of our patrons get a bonus segment each month called Digressions. We're on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find Chris and me on Twitter as well. Our website is bodyofevidence.ca. The Body of Evidence is not affiliated with the McGill Office for Science and Society and is a production of 1254-0851 Canada Inc. And when trying to decide if a study is good or not, remember the Body of Evidence creed.
A study in mice is not a study in people.
Coincidences are easy. Proving causation is hard.
Scientific studies are like movies. Some are just bad.
We can't stop at a single study. We have to look at the body of evidence.